8:30 a.m. KSDP Radio. I'm Kels Featherington, and this is Meet the People for November 18th, 2009. This morning, my guest is Nick Reed. Nick is the author of a new book entitled Selling to the C-Suite, What Every Executive Wants You to Know About Successfully Selling to the Top. The book was published by McGraw-Hill in 2009. Nick is also president of Sales Labs. The company helps companies drive predictable and repeatable revenue growth through the application of improved process, measurement, and skills. Reed is also a former executive director of Ernst & Young's Revenue Growth and Risk Management Practice. Well, with that introduction, Nick, good morning and welcome to the program, and thanks for being my guest.
Hey, good morning. Nice to be here.
Oh, I wanted to have you on the radio to talk about your new book, Selling to the C-Suite, because we are experiencing a very difficult economic time, and your book discusses what people can do to find work and keep their homes. Just to put the current climate in context for our listeners, U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner announced at the recent G20 meeting a 26-year high unemployment rate, saying that this reinforces that this is still a very tough economic environment. So what are job seekers in America to do?
Well, you know, one of the key things is to stay relevant. We see that there are some industries that are on the decline, others are on the uptick. The key would be to stay educated and remain relevant for the workplace and just keep yourself out there if you're unemployed. Make sure that you're researching the sorts of companies you'd like to get employment at and getting your resume out to them, putting it in context of what you can do to add value to that organization and its own growth path.
Well, how do you stay relevant if you're someone who was laid off perhaps more than a year ago?
Yeah, it may require some retraining, to look at the sorts of places that are employing, and that can be a challenge for people who have educated themselves and have skills in a certain area. But one of the things that employees need to bear in mind is that as employers are looking at how they grow their way out of the recession and what sorts of people they bring into the organization as jobs become available, industry experience in some cases is a relevant factor. But one of the things that they're looking more for now are people who have relevant behavioral skills and the ability to fit into the culture of their organization. So that's why we say stay relevant and research the companies that you're applying to so that you can tailor your application to show how well you'd fit in there and how you'd make a contribution.
Well, how do you prove to a prospective employer that you have relevant personality characteristics that they would like to have in their organization? That's a hard thing to do.
Well, the Internet's a marvelous tool for people seeking jobs. So, for example, if you type in the name of the company you're applying to and then you add to that the word culture, you'll find a whole lot of interesting stuff will typically come back where that company's been in the press talking about how they feel their culture is unique. And sometimes you can find there are some very good clues there as to what type of an organization you're applying to. You know, you have to remember that in an interview, the interviewer also enjoys being interviewed back. You know, they don't like it when applicants are talking to them and really have no great questions to ask about the company itself. So the better armed you are with good questions about how the role that you're applying for is going to contribute to the specific business challenges that you know that company's facing because they're in the press talking about those challenges, and the more you can talk about how would you recommend somebody starting in the job better fit into the culture to more immediately make a contribution? This leads to the sort of discussion that helps a candidate stand out against the sea of other applicants.
You know, I can't agree with you more. It is very much more difficult to ask the questions than to be the answerer of the questions in many cases. Not entirely true, but it's something that I've noticed. The current economic downturn has been compared to the Great Depression by some. From your perspective and as a thinker about the job market in the U.S., is the job situation today similar to what it was like during the Great Depression or in the years just following the Great Depression?
Well, what we see is that the Great Depression came at a time that's a little bit different to where we are. You know, we've come from a period of some great boom cycles, and it's corporate lack of corporate fiscal governance and all the things going on in Wall Street that to a great extent have caused the world to be where they are now. But one of the things that we see is that the cycle that we're in is probably going to take maybe a year or more to recover. A lot of companies say, well, we're on the upturn. A lot of economists say we've hit bottom and we're on the way up. The challenge, however, is that for revenue to start flowing into companies' bank accounts, they need to make that money, and that money starts with the sales cycles that their sales forces are making. And in many cases, the sales cycle from first customer call to money going into the bank can take more than a year. So, for the companies to start seeing economic improvement, we're probably going to go through what we call the recession's tail for the next 2 years at least. And that means that people have to really, bunker down.
Mm. For those of you who may be just joining us on 8:30 a.m. KSTV Radio, you're listening to Meet the People. I'm Kels Hetherington. My guest this morning is Nick Reed. Nick is the author of Selling to the C-Suite, What Every Executive Wants You to Know About Successfully Selling to the Top. The book was published in 2000 by McGraw-Hill. Are there ways in which the economy and the job market has fundamentally and forever changed in this deep, deep economic recession?
Well, we hear a lot of people talking about there being a jobless recovery. And what that means is that as companies have stripped heads out of the organization, they've learned to get by with fewer people, automating certain functions and just giving people, longer shifts to work, sometimes for no greater pay. That's become the norm. So the challenge is, if there's going to be a jobless recovery, the challenge is that that's going to mean possibly fewer jobs coming on the market. The challenge that we set out to chief executive officers and their boards then is to say to themselves, how can they take advantage of the current situation to grow their businesses as they plan how to move out of the recession? You know, it is possible to achieve exponential revenue growth if you put certain things in place in your business. And the stronger a business grows, then the more opportunity it has by necessity to put on jobs. And to our way of thinking, having the companies focus on rapid growth is the best formula for creating more jobs in the market and to get away from what the pundits are going to call a jobless recovery, because, frankly, that's really not going to help anybody.
Well, where are the jobs being created? There must be some new jobs being made.
Well, the biotech sector is a huge growth market at the moment. We see a lot of past IPOs in that area and companies moving forward very effectively. We see the services industries, the infrastructures that support companies, in the support area. IT is still moving forward very effectively, particularly in the software security area and the business intelligence areas. So, I think that what candidates really want to look for, if they've been laid off of a job and they're thinking about how to get back into the job market, or if they're somebody that's about to graduate and they're looking at the job market with trepidation saying, holy smokes, what do I do? The key there is to say, whatever training you have and whatever experience you bring to the table, try to find a way to channel it into the types of industries that do offer growth potential, because they're going to be the first ones to get recovery and, to stay abreast of those by, polling the internet and having a look at, growth industry, those two words, Google or Yahoo that, and in your local area, you'll start to see what is on the move.
Let's say you're in the unfortunate position of being a recent college graduate. How do you go about finding a job in this economic downturn when you have no experience and all the jobs you see advertised require and have as a prerequisite for being considered job experience?
Well, job experience comes in many forms, and you can get the hardliners that actually say, job experience means you have to have had 5 years in this industry. And in that case, if that's what the recruiter is looking for, then if they won't budge from that, then you have to move on to the next employer. But, experience comes in many forms, and experience really counts for nothing unless people know how to apply that. We talk to some organizations, and they employ salespeople, for example, and they say, I would only employ a salesperson with experience in my industry. And so let's say that their industry is something like computer hardware, and we say, well, explain the job that somebody has to do to sell effectively in this area. And they say, well, there's very long sales cycles. It involves having to get along with multiple stakeholders, and it usually involves convincing them to part with a lot of money. So you say, okay, well, would you consider somebody who sells insurance for this job? And they go, no, of course not. They don't have industry experience. And you say, well, hold on a second. Let's look at the insurance sales job. Don't they have to influence multiple stakeholders? You know, the husband, the wife, other people, maybe the accountant? Well, yes. Isn't the investment still a significant investment for the people at hand, whether it's, you know, a $100 policy or a $1 million deal? Well, yes. So, you know, putting it in context like that, they find that people from an industry altogether different to the one that they thought they'd recruit people from actually have absolutely relevant skills, because the role that they've been playing, even though it's in a different industry, is exactly the same. And so candidates and graduates really need to look at what they know and how they behave and put it in context for the employer to say, you know, the way that I behave and respond to situations is absolutely relevant for the job that you're offering, and that's why I'd make a great candidate for it.
You know, you're talking directly to the experience that a lot of our listeners have had. Alaska is geographically enormous, and many people in our listening area have skill sets that could actually be used in a different industry but are, you know, not and have never been. Unfortunately, there's often hesitation by employers to say, okay, I will broaden the search and accept resumes from a wider range and industry group of candidates. From the applicant's perspective, it may take some lobbying or kind of a strategy to get the employer to widen the search. How can an applicant do that?
Well, one of the interesting things, I mean, the book Selling to the C-Suite, which is available in all the bookstores and most of the online ones at the moment, is based on the 10-year research study that we did with executive buyers, the people who sign multi-million dollar contracts and the ones that sign off on employing people. And one of the questions that we asked them is, you know, what's the most effective way of, you know, somebody that's selling themselves to you to get on your radar and to make an impression such that you might actually change your mind of the decision criteria that you originally were thinking of in making this decision? And one of the interesting things they said was this, that if somebody approaches them directly, completely out of the blue, they don't know who this person is, maybe 4% of the time that person would get an audience and be successful in making their point. And that's a very low hit rate. Mm. But what they did say is that, however, if that person has first networked with somebody else lower down in the organization and has shown the initiative of wanting to learn a little bit about the company, asking some smart questions, and that person who's already employed there refers the candidate up to meet with this recruitment officer or executive, then 84% of the time they'll be successful not only in getting an audience, but with the person actually having a listen to what they have to offer and suggest. So from 4% to 84% is an enormous leap. And so if you spend the time contacting people who are doing the very job that you're applying for and asking them what works, what doesn't, what do they think is the way forward for that job, how do they think the company should be doing it better, these people are very accessible. They're much easier to talk to than the recruitment officer or the executive. And you start to get the inside track. And just by dropping their name and maybe asking them to refer you to meet with somebody in their recruitment office, you can improve your chances enormously and be armed with the right conversation to have when it comes time for the interview. That's a smart strategy.
Are there often jobs that are maybe available that are not advertised? Employers are willing to hire someone to do a particular task, but they maybe don't know they are looking for an employee until the right employee walks through their door.
Yeah, that can happen, and you know it depends on the industry. And in some companies, particularly government agencies, you know they have to advertise. They have to advertise internally and externally, you know, because of probity issues. But in the private sector, absolutely. Sometimes it takes a candidate, you know, researching the business, having a look at, you know, if you type in the company's name into any search engine and you type in next year's date, so say 2010, right, mm-hmm. and you type in the words strategy, challenge, initiative, those types of words, you'll get all sorts of hits of where the company's executives have appeared in the press, in their internal presentations to shareholders, all sorts of different places. And you can read through that and start to get a sense of really what's cooking in the mind of the executives there. And if you can understand what those issues are, then if you talk to those issues when you meet them and say, I have a skill set and I have a background and I'm aware of what's going on in your market and I believe that here's a specific contribution that I could probably make to your business, sometimes they'll create roles for you. You know, well, I'll never forget one of the executives that we interviewed saying that what they really value is somebody who brings ideas to them that not even their own management are talking about. And if they have to go outside the company to bring that value inside, then they will, and they'll create a role.
Nick, there are many social networking tools available to folks today on the internet. In particular, there's like LinkedIn. Is that an effective way to connect with people you might know vaguely or who you're trying to meet in order to get connected and the inside track to a job opportunity at some company? Or do you need to know the people in the real world, so to speak?
Yeah. That's a great question, and a lot of people wonder about that. I think the answer to it is that having your site up on LinkedIn, it's nice to have it there, but if people don't know you in context, it may not mean as much as actually having connected to you. So word of mouth and personal referral will still trump having something on LinkedIn. One of the other social networking things that people often point to is, pointing employers to their Facebook page or whatever. Some of the most effective approaches of doing that is if people have two different sort of online sort of pages for themselves. There's the social one where they show pictures of their last holiday and their favorite kitten and all of that to their friends, and that social network. But there's another one that has a harder business edge to it, or all the things that they've done as a graduate to demonstrate how clever they are and how relevant they are in the workplace. You don't want a prospective employer looking you up on the internet, as most of them do these days, to see what sort of person you are, and hitting the wrong site. So if you're applying for a job, create a site like that that's full of relevant information for the industry that you're applying to, makes yourself look like a player. And that's one of the key things that would be a tip for the social networking side of things.
It's said that a large number of people are out of work today. It's over 10% now, which is a shocking number. And as your book talks about, there are an awful lot of people who are underemployed in part-time positions or two-thirds positions, whatever. What demographic in America is being the hardest hit in the current economic downturn?
Well, funnily enough, you find the people that are in their prime that have the highest expectations for earning are the ones that are often marginalized out. Employers are looking for younger talent that they can get for less money if they can pull that off, and people that are in moving towards semi-retirement who have all the experience in the world and who are grateful to still be working. So you get this big swathe of people in the 30 to 50 bracket who have the most to gain and have the greatest appetite for earning, and for some employers that makes them a target for putting a red line through that demographic. So the counterpoint to that argument is to say that these are the people who typically do have a modicum of experience already, and they don't come with the health risks, and that they've got all the energy and probably more to work for than some of the others, because they are having their young families and so forth. So there's an argument on both sides, and prospective employees need to really market themselves aggressively as somebody who can make a contribution, who understands how the role is going to make that contribution to the organization's mission, and can articulate that clearly to the people that they're hoping to get employment with. If you put those things together, then you should stand out amongst a sea of other applicants.
If you're just joining us here on 8:30 a.m. KSDP, this is Meet the People. I'm Cal Featherington. My guest this morning is Nick Reed. We've got about 10 more minutes left in the program. Nick is the author of Selling to the C-Suite, What Every Executive Wants You to Know About Successfully Selling to the Top. The 2009 book was published by McGraw-Hill. It's available on Amazon.com, I suspect, Nick, right?
Yeah, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Borders.com as well.
Right here in Sandpoint and King Cove, there's no local book retail outlet, so people will need to go online. They can do it. Again, the name of the book is Selling to the C-Suite, What Every Executive Wants You to Know About Successfully Selling to the Top. And Nick Reed, Nick is spelled N-I-C, and then Reed. It's kind of funny that you would publish a book and your last name would be Reed. Kind of ironic, right?
Hey, I always knew I'd be a writer because of that last name, there's no doubt.
If you'd been Reed Wright, like first name Reed, last name Wright, then you'd really be in. But this is close enough. Now, a lot of people who may have lost their job, have been out of work for a while, if you fall into that category, you're still looking for that full-time job to replace the one you lost, maybe 12 months ago, you have an urge to get going on something. Is that something that is wise to move forward with and get a part-time position, or should you just continue, if you can afford it, to look for the full-time job to replace the one you lost? Which is more beneficial to your job campaign?
Well, I think rather than look at what's more beneficial to the job campaign, you have to look at the realities per person of what's more beneficial to them. I mean, if they're tapping out of money, you have to take work. And I don't think that having a part-time role precludes you from having a full-time role when the right one comes along. In fact, I think most employers would rather hire somebody that's engaged in some activity there rather than somebody who's sitting at home. You know, success breeds success, and so there's a certain stigma that employers see with people who are really not doing anything. So, you know, the advice would be go volunteer if you can't get, you know, paid work even in a part-time capacity. Demonstrate that you're actively engaged in something, and the more you put out, the more it will come around to you. But don't sit on the couch and do nothing. That's a big turnoff.
What are red flags that people should be careful of when putting together a resume?
That's a great question. You know, we live in an attention deficit world with so much white noise competing for our attention these days that recruiters don't have time to read lengthy War and Peace resumes. As much as we want to talk and tell them everything about ourselves, they don't have the time for it. So brief is better. Two-page resumes are a great idea. If you have a Facebook or some other online page that's formatted in such a way that it looks like, it's business-centered or career-focused, as I said before, maybe have two, one for your social side and one for your business side. It's always good to point them to that if they want all the detail on you. But a two-page resume is typically what you'd want to have. And, you know, the cover letter for that should really focus on showing that you've done your sleuthing, you've done your detective work, you've done your homework on them, and you can say something like, you know, looking at your organization and the role that I'm applying for, it seems to me that here's the top three things that the role contributes to. The next piece you would say is, here's the specific talents and background and skills that I bring to the table, and here's what I believe I can contribute that you can't get from other candidates. And then, you know, you would summarize whatever education or career history that you've had without going into too much detail. But what detail you do go into, for heaven's sake, make sure that it lists the things that you've achieved that have some sort of number or, you know, percentage, you know, or quality, you know, result attached to them. Because executives and recruiters don't just want to know where you worked and what role you played. They want to know what impact you made. You know, they look at track record. They look at the business value that you've contributed, because past success breeds future success, and that's really what they're looking for.
What about when a potential employer says, why did you leave such and such an organization? Should you say, I left because I was fired, if that's the case, or should you just say, something more bland than that? Well, what's the recommended course of action?
Well, it comes down to how you want to package it. I mean, If you're talking to a recruiter and you get a sense that they call a shovel, you know, and they don't pad things out, you can be quite open with them and say, well, you know, that company faced massive layoffs, and when they brought the accountants in, my entire job section was one that they put a red line through, if that's the way that it went. And people understand that these days, you know, that we're no strangers and there's no stigma to being sort of part of a corporate layoff. If you were fired for some other reason, and you know that when they do their reference checking, that may come up, it's probably a good idea to say, well, you know, we learned that we weren't a good fit, and here were some of the reasons why. But don't make it personal, you know, trying to make it business, and saying, here's what I learned from that experience, and here's how I, you know, am doing better now, you know. But most times, you know, if it's part of a corporate layoff and you're one of many people that were laid off, then I think employers are understanding of that, and that there's no reason to be ashamed of bringing that up. Just talk about it openly.
Well, as you work with executives in your role as president of Selling Labs, is that what it is? Sell Labs. What are things that you look for or advise them to search for in resumes of prospective employees that they should be very, very cautious of? What are the top three red flags that you look for?
If the applicants don't put any measurements to their list of achievements, so where they just list a bunch of names of companies that they've worked for, and there's no listed achievement there, that's always a red flag. You eliminate those right off the bat. If somebody's actually done something that's worth talking about, you expect it to be in the resume. And if it's absent, then you figure that they were asleep at the wheel or hoping that the company was going to make them successful but actually didn't make a contribution. So it's really important for applicants to think about, well, what did I contribute in that past role, and can I put a number to it, as to what benefit that was? So it's one of the things that you'd look for. The absence of that is a huge red flag. Some of the other red flags are people who have bounced from job to job to job. Some people, when they're putting their resumes together, will want to find that the jobs that they spent the longest time at and focus on those. And, in between time, say, in between here and here, there were several smaller jobs. But, just hit the keystrokes, the major parts of your career history that you're proudest of, that you have the best story to tell. But when employers see that you've gone, the last 10 years you've worked 12 different jobs, then there'd be questions as to why. So that's a red flag. And, putting down stories or things that just don't pan out. I know of one executive who was finishing an exhaustive recruitment project for a key role that they had. They went from 200 applicants down to the final three, and they selected the final one from that. And when they looked closer at just matching the job histories that they had, they found that they'd worked in one job for 3 years, but they'd stated on their resume that they'd actually worked there for five. So when they rang that employer and sort of checked on what that was, did a little bit more digging, they found that extra 2 years that they weren't spending in that place, they'd spent in prison or something. So, talking to the executive, they said, we discounted that guy immediately, and it wasn't because they'd spent time in prison. If they'd been upfront about that, that would have been better. It was the fact that there was information that had been fudged. So, being deceitful in some of the resumes is a red flag. You usually get caught out, so don't do it.
Curious, how many people lie on their resumes?
The real answer is probably upward of 70%. But it's small little things that they want to iron out from their career. Saying that they had a job title that was slightly different to the one that they had, to give themselves the impression that they're on the fast track. You see that a lot of times in candidates who've worked in companies that are no longer around, so there's nobody to check the facts with. You'll see salespeople going to sales director, and you'll see, clerical assistant going to chief engineer.
Yeah, very creative, yeah.
You see that all the time. But I think everybody has an obligation to paint themselves in the most positive light they can in a competitive job market, so long as you don't sort of push it too far.
Now, your new book, Selling to the C-Suite, What Every Executive Wants You to Know About Successfully Selling to the Top, it's from McGraw-Hill in 2009. There's some advice that you give employers in the book. What kind of advice do you give employers and managers in a downturn?
Well, look, in a downturn, they really need to take stock of the business and recognize that now is a terrific opportunity to grow. If you look at past recessions, it was the companies that didn't cut back on some of the things that they might be tempted to cut back on and actually pushed forward in those areas that actually grew. For example, companies that typically slashed headcount and lost an enormous knowledge base out of their business. It takes years to rebuild that knowledge base of people who've been around. Some of the most successful companies are those that resist the urge to get rid of too many people. and they try to preserve, the esprit de corps that the company has, and push forward. That's a value judgment, though. It's something that comes from the very top. So it really depends on who's leading the business. But we recommend that people preserve the knowledge base of the company so that they can move forward, because knowledge is a form of currency that's very difficult to replace. We recommend that that they take stock of their business and figure out, so in a market where people aren't spending, where are they spending? And how can we create a value proposition to be attractive to the part of the marketplace that is still spending money, that's relevant to what we do? Some companies have to create new business units, create new product lines,
and
diversify.
And with that comment in mind, Nick, I'd ask you, are there certain places and areas in this country where the job market is still pretty good? And what are those areas geographically?
Oh, so if people want to jump on a plane and move somewhere,
mm-hmm.
I think we're living in an era where that type of approach is not as relevant as it used to be. And the reason for that is that there are so many companies who are employing people remotely, and they're working in a home office, for example, and they don't necessarily have to report into a plant or a place. That's a certain type of job category that can pull that off. Administration, outsourced consulting, servicing, telephone work. So there's a lot of the financial services industry, not just because of government bailout money, but, because those insurance companies and so forth, they have, massive marketing still on TV. They have massive call center staff, some of them in call centers, some of them working from home. A lot of work-from-home moms employed in that sector. And they're all over the place, so I don't think it's as simple as saying, is there a geography? Because we live in a globalized world where remote operating is becoming more the norm.
Well, thank you so much, Nick, for coming on the radio and being my guest. Nick is the author of the recently published book by McGraw-Hill. The book is entitled Selling to the C-Suite, What Every Executive Wants You to Know About Successfully Selling to the Top. Thank you so much, Nick.
Well, thank you. I hope if your listeners read the book that they'll be able to profit from it, and it'll make a difference to them.
Appreciate your time. All right.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
That was Nick Reed. He is, as we just said, the author of a new book from McGraw-Hill. It was published in 2009. The book's entitled Selling to the C-Suite, What Every Executive Wants You to Know About Selling to the Top. We'll now go to NPR News from Washington, D.C. in just a moment. But first, this.
This portion of the news is underwritten by Wells Fargo National Bank member FDIC, a proud sponsor of KSDP Radio News.
Programming on KSDP is brought to you by Telalaska, continuing a tradition of innovation and excellence, connecting businesses across Alaska through an advanced statewide data network. From office to office, town to town, to the world outside. At
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Attorney General Eric Holder says the trials of five accused terrorists in connection with the 9/11 attacks